Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Patrick Martins, your host of The Main Course. We are broadcasting live out of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street and engineered by Joe Galarraga in the studio. Hey, Joe.
How's it going, Patrick?
How's your weekend? Any big news this weekend or over the course of the week at the station?
Any big news over the course of the week at the station? Well, we had some really good coverage of the James Beard Awards that was done by Jack and Marianne Cotlier and all the crew over at the office, so that was pretty sweet.
Very, very cool. Well, good news for you, Joe, because this is such a good show and we've got two guests, I am going to spare you and our listeners an intro. I am just going to get right into our first guest. And he's sitting in studio, so you might hear from him in the meantime. But we're going to talk to Steve Jenkins, one of the foremost important people in the country for introducing Americans to the finest European cheeses and olive oils and olives and a number of other products. And he is with an owner of Fairway Market, which is an institution for people here in New York. So we always love having Steve in. He's also one of our iconoclast evolutionaries, and he was the first one we ever did. So it's a big honor to have him. And I am also very honored to have someone who I've known for 6 years now. I mean, probably seen you a few times a week, every week for 6 years. So we've got Bonnie Pipkin. Welcome, Bonnie.
Hi.
And we also have her business partner in endofthelinedining.com, Tanya Riles.
Hello.
Riles. How are you guys?
We're good.
So tell us about this End of the Line Dining. It's a New York City dining adventure that you guys dreamed up many years ago and are finally putting into action.
Yep.
So tell us about it.
Okay. So End of the Line Dining is...
Pull the mic up right to the mouth. It moves.
You
don't have, so you don't have to.
I'm bending into the microphone. All right, that makes life easier. twice a month, Tanya and I take a subway line to the end of the line and find a restaurant and eat there and then blog about our adventure. So
very cool. So now, End of the Line. So for our listeners who are not from New York, there's dozens of railroad lines and listed, and every subway is the beginning stop and the end stop, but hardly anyone ever goes to those end stops because they get off somewhere in between.
Exactly.
So you take it all the way.
All the way, all the way. And there are 44 end destinations, so this project will take us a couple of years to get through. But
Do you find? So you get off the end of the line, and do you do research before, or do you just show up? Tanya, how's it work when you get there?
So we're making up the rules as we go along, but for now the rules are we can only do research about the neighborhood. So it's demographics, just cultural aspects
history of
the neighborhood, but we're not allowed to do any research with respect to any restaurants. So no Yelp, no internet. When we get to the neighborhood, we can only use our phones to take pictures. We can't use Google Maps. We can't research or look up anything. So it's all about sort of the exploration or our own exploration of the neighborhood. So we may not find the best restaurant or we may not find, the most representative of the neighborhood, but it's about our journey of exploration to find some place to eat.
That's a really cool idea to turn off all internet, because it's like in the old days.
Yeah. We like to say we're looking up instead of looking down. We're not looking down into our phones. We're just looking around the neighborhood and taking it all in. So
when you do research into a culture that might, congregate at the end of one of the subway lines, you'll look for restaurants from that culture, or oftentimes I'm sure there's more than one culture.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of in the beginning stages, so it's hard to say that there's a norm so far, but yeah, I mean, culturally, there's so many cultures in New York City, so any neighborhood that you go to, you're going to find so many different options, and yeah.
So tell us about some of these stories. Like, what have been some of your best experience? I know the worst experience has got to be the White Castle, because there must have been very few choices if you go there. But tell me about some of the more fun experiences. First of all, do you announce yourselves when you get to the restaurant, or are you just incognito?
We haven't. At the last restaurant we went to, we ended up telling our server about the project, because we, you know, developed a little rapport with her, and we really dug her. But I just want to let you know, we never did end up at White Castle. We actually...
Oh, okay.
It was danger zone, because we were in Jamaica, Queens, and we couldn't find anything that seemed fresh or... And so we were resigned, and we were heading towards White Castle, and we're like, oh man, do we really have to pull this card out already? but then we looked across the street and saw a Peruvian restaurant and ended up eating there, which was...
Yeah, awesome. We're going to talk about her, because she was not Peruvian, the woman you talked to, right? Mm-mm. Well, tell us about that. So she was, her name was Jenny?
Yeah, her name was Jenny. So it's interesting. We walked in the restaurant, and there was an A on the window, so we had been told in that neighborhood that you need to watch what you eat and make sure it's fresh, and we saw A in the window, and I've never been so happy to see an A in the window before.
You didn't think they really got out that far.
Yeah, right.
So we walked in, and she approached us, and she was so nice, and the first thing she said was, I've never seen you guys in the neighborhood before. Are you new to this neighborhood? And
stuck out like sore thumb.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely in that neighborhood felt like we were being watched a little bit.
Yeah. And so she gave us the menu, and it was a Peruvian restaurant. So the first thing she said is, do you know about Peruvian food? Is there anything I can help you with? Is there anything I can tell you about? And so we made the decision that all the restaurants we were going to go to, we were going to ask for a recommendation or a chef's choice. Just bring us out. What's your best dish? Which has been a little bit more confusing to people than we expected it to be. People are a little baffled when you ask for their opinion sometimes. But she right away said, you know, let me recommend this ceviche. There's the ceviche of Corvina. It's one of the main Peruvian dishes. And then she went on to tell us about how her husband was from Peru. She had spent 2 or 3 years in Peru, and they had recently come to Jamaica, Queens to open this restaurant. It had been open for about 4 months, and so she was telling us it was very seafood based. And
she's from Trinidad, right?
She was from Trinidad, yeah. So and you can tell their whole family was there. Her husband was there. He was very kind. He took our picture.
He tried to put us up on Facebook, but it never actually got there. Oh, yeah.
They might have A's out there, but not high-speed internet.
Yeah, right.
No, but so very interesting. So, yeah, there must be a lot more mom-and-pop joints out there. Because, like, if you're a mom-and-pop joint on 34th and 8th Avenue, I mean, you better be doing pretty damn well to pay the rent. But out there, it kind of opens itself up to more home cooking, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's you know, we went to, for example, we went to Bedford Park in the Bronx at the end of the B line, and it's at the end of the line, it was pretty desolate. We really had a hard time finding a restaurant in that neighborhood. We're hoping to find more mom and pop stuff and more you know, more interesting restaurants than White Castle.
So the end of the beeline, not so good.
Well, we enjoyed ourselves. Part of this experience is about the adventure of it.
Right.
And, but, you know, not a lot of restaurants up there. I guess people aren't eating out in that neighborhood.
Well, when there's a wealth of choices, how do you pick? Because, you know, a lot of these restaurants probably don't look fantastic inside. You know, like the typical, they say, the worse the restaurant looks, the better the Chinese food.
Right.
You know, I wonder how it works there.
Well, you know, when we can, we try to get a recommendation from someone. We try to talk to people if we're not feeling too shy. Mm-hmm. So when we were in Forest Hills, we ended up chatting with a lady who recommended a Malaysian restaurant that was really delicious. Mm. And let's see, what else? What else did we go to? Yeah, I mean, we just kind of Bay Ridge, we wandered for a while. We were sitting in one diner, sat down, looked at the restaurant or at the menu, and we're just like, I think we can do better than this. Yeah, so we had a cup of coffee and then ended up finding a Lebanese place. But it's random.
I love Lebanese food.
Yeah, it was delicious.
How much fun.
Tabbouleh, baba ganoush.
You can be as cynical as you want, but I think that's just the most fun. I'm so forgiving, and I want, you know, little guys like that to succeed, but it's so much fun. I just love the idea of this website.
Yeah, it's a very interesting website. And then also the culture of the train itself, because, I mean, entire culture is probably come onto the train, stay on the train, leave the train, new culture comes on, stay on the train, leave on the train, because these are long subway lines. For $2, you can go from Far Rockaway to Riverdale, practically.
Yeah, this is why we're New Yorkers. This is what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, it's cool. It's kind of like being a tourist in our own city, going to like the far reaches and seeing new pockets and new places.
Because
cool.
They also must not get that much attention. I mean, these are not the Mario Batali, Danny Meyer restaurants. Yeah. These are, you know, one-offs, one restaurant, end of the line, very few tourists probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so, and then do you contact them after and say, hey?
No, I mean, we'll probably start doing that. We've only been going for a couple of months now, so we've only gone to 4 places. We're actually, after we leave here, we're going to take the F line down to Coney Island. So.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Hey, Joe, maybe we could talk to Jack and Aaron about having these cats come in and do a little bit of a restaurant review, you know, for the end of some of their things, like separate, you know, from a show or whatever, so people could you know, try it. Because Coney Island, I mean, a lot of people go there.
Brighton Beach, my goodness. There's so many great Russian joints, Ukrainian joints.
Yeah, Brighton Beach has actually been a really difficult one for us.
Making a choice.
Not making a choice. Well, we can get recommendations from people, so we've got really great recommendations, but actually getting there has been the challenge for us. Because even though we're doing this project, we haven't been the best about researching the subway lines themselves. So the second time we did End of the Line Dining, we went to go to Brighton Beach, and it was Saturday, and the line doesn't run on Saturday.
Oh, brother.
So we've been trying to make it down to Brighton Beach since we started, actually. So we'll get there eventually.
We heard Tatiana's was a good one in Brighton Beach.
I've heard of it.
Anyone else has any good recommendations on our website, we take recommendations. So if there's a place where we should be seeing, then you can leave us a comment.
Well, my mom is a Russian Jew, and she always says the Russians never had a particularly stellar cuisine.
Vodka.
Vodka is a good thing.
It's not borscht, and it's not potatoes.
Right. Well,
you know,
right.
It's mostly berries and things that you can preserve. Everything's pickled in Russian cuisine.
Because it's freezing there.
Yep.
They have a very short growing season. But it is interesting. I mean, in New York, there's this one place, I think, called like the Samovar or whatever. But essentially, it's hard to find.
We just went to Mar Ivana on 20th Street and had a great time.
Russian food?
Yeah.
So kreplach and borscht, all that?
Really good menu. Really good menu.
Awesome.
Mar Ivana.
Arivana.
Well, M-A-R-I, Vanna.
Maybe that's the end of a bus line or something. Maybe. That'll be the next phase.
After a couple of years,
So that's what you'll have to do in L.A. when they have the L.A. branch. Just take buses to the end of the line.
You're like the end of 405 to Santa Monica. Get off at the pier. Well, this is End of the Line Dining, all spelled out, .com. It's a very fun website, and it's for a born and raised New Yorker like myself, it's fun to see all the subway maps, and, you know, because all those places are practically household names.
Yeah.
You know, the end of these lines, like, I forget the L train. What's the end?
Canarsie.
Canarsie, right.
Castle
Did you go there?
Hill, you know.
Oh, yeah, we'll be going there.
For sure.
Yeah.
So I really recommend you guys check out that website. And since we have another few minutes to kill, I was looking if there were any extra fun facts about you two cats. And I saw on your website, ever hear about the naked waitress?
Yes.
So, Bonnie?
Well, you're hearing it here first, because there's been a mystery around who this naked waitress is, if you didn't know her.
This
personally is
my biggest scoop ever. I swear to God.
I used to work at Roberta's. I was one of the people that started it up, helped build it.
Pulsating heart of Roberta's, Bonnie.
My blood and guts and tears and sweat are in the walls of this restaurant.
You were the longest tenured employee here for a number of years.
Indeed. I was the last standing original server. And so I knew when I decided to leave that I needed to go out big. so My last shift, I wore a trench coat the whole night, and for the last half an hour of my shift, I took that trench coat off, and I was naked and serving food.
So. I've had dreams like that.
That is beautiful. Yeah. Ah, the trench coat, I loved it. The stereotypical last bit of covering before something naked happens.
Yeah, well, no, everyone knew something was up, but I didn't let anyone know what was going on. So did
that, how, what happened? What was the reaction you got? Did you feel weird doing it? I mean, how did it play out? It was legendary. I mean, there wasn't a blog or website or email list that did not talk about this,
yeah,
but no one knew who it was.
My name never got published anywhere, which was kind of cool. I liked the mystique around it. Uh-huh.
The clients must have been ecstatic.
Yeah, it was fun. It was very celebratory. I mean, the restaurant sort of erupted in applause, and Tanya was actually there eating the night.
Oh, wow.
Did
you know it was going to happen?
I mean, when I saw her in the trench coat, I was pretty sure that I knew how it was going to end.
Yeah, I wanted my friends to be there for the show.
She was wearing fishnets. I can say that she was, in fact,
she was
wearing
a
fishnets.
That's true. That's true. Wide fishnets. There was nothing hiding under those fishnets. I never would have guessed how it blew up. I was on Fox 5 News and stuff.
Yeah.
And so.
Isn't that exciting to just
cool.
secretly have a secret like that so many millions of people are, literally millions of people are talking about?
Yeah, it was cool. I definitely had to give my parents a call and let them know before they discovered it on the internet.
Did they say, thanks for keeping us abreast of the situation?
They said, why did you do that? You're so weird.
How did the guys at Roberta's, I asked Chris a few days after, and he was like, I think it's great.
Everybody was, it was, like I said, it wasn't like, it was celebratory, so.
Yeah, I mean, it was at the end of the shift.
Yeah, absolutely.
So only the most hardcore diners were still left.
No children.
Yeah. Although that would have been cool. As a kid, as Steve said, that's like a dream come true for any kid.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was awesome. It was definitely one of the best stunts I've ever pulled. I've been trying to get attention for that kind of stuff for a long time, I guess, and now it's happened.
It would have been nice to have cameras on all the people as they were writing the checks, you know, a $10 tip, and then you do that, and then they add one more zero. They're like, I'll never forget this.
Yeah, it was cool. It was really cool.
Well, thank you so much for being on. I really think it would be exciting if the station could be a vehicle to communicate some of these end-of-the-line stories.
Absolutely. We'd love to come back and talk
to you. I'm going to put you on the Fairway website so people can link it.
Oh, awesome. Great. Thank you so much.
That's actually infinitely more powerful than us allowing.
That's cool. We want more people to know about it and more people to read. And we want you to subscribe to our blog, too, so you can know when we put new posts up. So
that is how you show belief and commitment to a cool idea like this. You sign up, but you follow what's going on. So thank you so much for being on.
Thank you for having us.
You guys are welcome to stay in studio. I know Steve would love to watch you guys.
Feel free to take off your clothes.
So we're going to take a very short break, and we're going to come back with Steve Jenkins. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Snickers by Obesity on the heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Well, that was exciting. That was hot. It was interesting. I am very happy everyone is still sitting in studio. Feel free to chime in if you have any questions for Steve.
Sure.
So Steve Jenkins was our first ever Evolutionary. It's a new series of the very most important people in the food world. Not just people we like, but people who have really shifted the movement, you know, above and beyond where it was before. So, Steve, we're so happy to have you back.
I love being out here with you, Patrick.
Yeah, you're like Marv Albert on David Letterman. You're the one, probably the guest we've had the most across the station.
But so, I'm usually here with Katie, but this is so nice to be here with more pretty girls.
Yes, exactly.
Than just Katie.
So, you're credited, of course. You know, I think people associate you most, with the cheese primer. You know, people who really don't know, know about the cheese primer. So, but you are also obviously involved with other foods. Most importantly, olive oil is probably, you've equaled your reputation in olive oil as you have with cheese when you first started the Dean and DeLuca cheese counter in the early 80s, late 70s. So let's talk about olive oil.
But as for books, everybody knows that dumb cheese book I wrote. Hell, it's almost, 16 years old
now. It's the Bible of cheese.
Yeah, really. My picture's on the cover, and I look like a little boy. So I take a ribbing about that constantly. But it's the other book that I wrote a few years ago that nobody's read, which is usually the way it goes with most people's second book. HarperCollins didn't promote it at all, so nobody even knew it existed. And it's called The Food Life.
Uh-huh.
And it's just essay after essay that I could disgorge from everything I've been doing for 40 years. So it's sort of important. You know, anybody does anything for 40 years, I want to know the highlights.
That guy's a master.
What that person did. Yeah. I don't care if he was sweeping or dusting or shellacking a wall. I want to know about the highlights. So this is what I've been doing for 40 years. The Food Life.
What and are some of the essays? Like, give us some of the things, lessons.
Oh, my gosh. I wrote about how I used to go to Paris all by myself, a callow fellow like you used to be a few short years ago.
Yes.
But back when I was in my mid to late 20s and at Dean and DeLuca as their first employee, anytime I'd get any time off, I'd scrounge together enough money to get on Air India or Iceland Air, mm-hmm. And have a layover in Reykjavik on the way to London. It wouldn't even fly me to Paris.
Why? Because those ones were cheaper to get there?
Yeah, it was the only way I could get on. Nobody was paying for me in those days. I was using my own money, and I was making $200 a week back in '77.
Wow!
You know, and I'd go to Paris, but I'd have to go by way of Reykjavik and London to get there.
A little age shark before you got
all the way.
And
I'd always stay in the same seedy little hotel on the Rue de Seine.
Uh-huh.
And I would constantly go down to the stalls. You know, a stall is not like a stall in a bathroom. A stall is a flat table that artisans put out in front of their shops. That is what a stall is. And the Rue de Seine, from one end of it to the other, was stalls out inside of all of these wonderful shops. Mm-hmm. And they would sell food. Whatever their specialty was on those tables. So I'd go down there at the crack of dawn and watch them set up. And I'd just stand there sort of behind a pole and watch them wait on people all morning. And I'd watch them close it down for their lunchtime and everything. And I'd be back there in the afternoon when they opened up again, when it began to get dark. It was always in wintertime, it seemed like to me. It was cold, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of diesel fumes in the air, but it was the most romantic, wonderful thing in the world because, the best cheese guy in the world, Barthelemy, was on that street. The best fruity vendor, the best fruit and vegetable people were there. The great fishmonger was there. Rue de Bussy and the great Italian shop was right there. So I would hang out there all day because it was just like porno to me.
Yeah.
It was just raw food in its most elemental way, and I'd watch them close up at night and hose everything down and put what little they had left over back in a box in hopes that they'd probably take it home or give it away or something, because everything was fresh every day, and that's how I made my bones.
Now, were you researching? Were you taking notes, or were you just watching?
It was all in my head. I would write down labels constantly. of cheeses. I would write down the name.
Because you couldn't find any of these cheeses at all in America, nowhere.
No, nobody, nobody. Nobody had any of these cheeses or any of that charcuterie or
it's any wild
olive
to think
oil
of.
Or anything in those days, and didn't until I really got it going in the early 80s.
Soho, right? Soho store. That was
exactly.
The first bastion.
I bought all the cheese. Most of the French cheeses then came into Dina De Luca, but then I went to pasta and cheese, and that's when I started going to Milano and wandering around so I could do the same thing in Italy that I did in France, was just steal it blind, just rob France for everything it had and bring it to New York. So I started doing it in Milano, and one day I just ran literally smack into the Casa di Formaggio in Milano, and here's this most magnificent of cheese shops I've ever seen in my life, except everything in it was Italian. There was no Greek, there was no Spanish, there was no French. It was all Italian cheeses, none of which, except for maybe Parmigiano Reggiano and Grana Padano, were available in New York City, Pecorino Romano. But nothing else was available. And I literally looted every region in Italy, because they were all represented in the Casa di Formaggio of the Stoppani brothers, which was called Peck. Everyone's heard of Peck. This was the Peck Casa di Formaggio.
Wow.
And this is why New York, in 1979, got its first shipments ever of Fontina d'Aosta and Robbiola from Piemonte.
Connect the dots. How the hell did you bring all that over? I mean, I imagine customs had never seen them.
I came back and I went to Henry Kaplan at Amazon de Choix Coffee, who was my importer.
Okay.
And I gave him my list of Italian stuff, and I gave him the phone number for Peck and the people, and they called him up, and by God, put everything onto a pallet, and I took it to an airport. Took it to Linate in south of Milano and flew it into Kennedy for me.
That's the LaGuardia
of Milano.
And Mimi
Sheridan wrote it up. Mimi Sheridan wrote it up. It's the first time I was validated in print as having pioneered all this stuff. I never really got any credit for it, for what I did for France. It was just sort of de rigueur, you know.
Right.
It would get in the New York Times, but Florence never said, Steve Jenkins brought this French cheese to New York. It just said that, you know, Dina De Luca has seven kinds of veritable Camembert that have never been. But Mimi Sheridan wrote it up, and by God, she said, Steve Jenkins did this. You know, I worshipped her then, and I worship her now. In fact,
she's still alive.
Mimi called me last week. That's a great feeling to have Mimi Sheridan call you. I mean, it was like at Fairway when I would wait on Georges Balanchine.
Oh, wow.
Or Lenny Bernstein. You know, I felt like I'd been anointed when they'd walk up the counter and go, hello, Stephen. Have Georges Balanchine say, hello, Stephen.
Stephen, that's
the
nice.
Same thing for me to have Mimi Sheridan call me on the phone. Steve, when are you guys going to open up in the village?
Yeah, I don't want to walk so
down
far.
Here.
That's funny.
I said, well, Mimi, we are looking for real estate. And she says, take the Jefferson Market. It's been laying there like a lox for years. You guys ought to be in the Jefferson Market.
Right.
And I said, we'll have a look, and I'll call you back. But what we were talking about was this wonderful book I wrote that nobody read called The Food Life. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about the essays that I wrote in it. And, you know, the one that came to mind was when I used to always hang out in Paris day after day after day like a idiot savant. All I did was watch shopkeepers open, wait on people, and close. And for me, that was a good time.
That was real entertainment. So now you break all these barriers down with cheese, and then years later, you kind of do the same with olive oil. So
yeah.
This is like your second book, but
Patrick,
through food.
I've been thinking about why I've sort of let my people run my cheese operation, and I don't really interfere very much anymore for years now. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the industry knows it. They know that I don't really lift a finger for the cheese anymore. And I was thinking why a control freak like me would allow that to happen. And you know, I finally realized why, Patrick.
Why?
It's because I kept being told by the government, you can't have that. Mm. You can't have that. We won't let you have that. You're not allowed to bring in all those Fermier chefs. You're not allowed to have real Camembert or real Brie. You're not
milk issue?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How could I claim to be the master cheesemonger that everybody knows I am and that I'm proud as heck about? How could I operate as a master cheesemonger when fully 40-45% of what I want in my counter I'm not allowed to have because of our idiot FDA? It doesn't sit well with me. I don't like being told that you can't have something that's perfectly okay for you.
Yeah.
I mean, if folks were dropping dead or getting sick even from this stuff in Europe, don't you think we'd know about it?
Yeah, more people die from the industrial pasteurized kind than
exactly.
From that, so.
People get sick from dead milk cheese. They don't get sick from cheese that's made by people who are invested in every single move they make. They get sick from Jarlsberg and crummy mozzarella from a dirty factory. You know, listeriosis is a post-pasteurization phenomenon. This is what happens when you muck about with something and take everything out of it. Suddenly it's a clean slate. And any rogue bacteria that are introduced after the fact are going to run wild because there's no natural selection. We don't understand that that's the way it's supposed to be. And besides that, all of those bacteria, thousands and thousands of different species of bacteria are in any given substance, certainly milk, but those are flavor molecules. And those are also little critters that you want in your gut in order to withstand the vagaries of what we do all day.
If everything you eat is so immaculate
mm-hmm. yeah. that you're feeling really good about yourself, you're a fool because you're going to get sick.
Yeah. First microbes are going to come around. Well, Carl Pacini, the founder of Slow Food, used to call for an international defense for microbes. He wanted a movement for microbes.
I love it.
So was that frustration?
Critters.
What's that?
Critters.
Critters.
Like being called critters.
Flavor molecule yeah, critters.
They're good critters. Yeah. One in a thousand is a bad critter. And it's not going to hurt you. You'll be able to handle it. You got hydrochloric acid in your stomach. But our government, in their wisdom, like to put their fingers into everything everybody does.
And they want to protect the sickest, the oldest, and the youngest, and then meanwhile everyone else has to eat miserable food.
Exactly.
Is that why you got into olive oil? Because you were frustrated that cheese wasn't high enough of a ceiling?
Exactly, Patrick.
So that's what I realized.
I got tired of being pushed around by the government all the time.
So you traveled to Spain and Italy, and you just, they, of course, knew you, I'm sure, through the cheeses, and you introduced yourself. And how do you partner with an Italian or a Spanish guy and convince him to give you half or all of his output?
By being polite, by being genuine and nice and not a piggish American and just prostrating yourself and saying, I'll do whatever I have to do to keep you from filtering that olive oil. I know it's going to cost you money to not filter my olive oil, but you know, I want it cloudy, stuff like that. But you know, you have to back up a little bit. It's much more important that you be so acquainted with the geography of these places around the Mediterranean basin that you already know where you're going to get the best stuff. And if you know the neighborhood like I do, because I've been there so many times, it's not a hard jump to find the Grove and the Miller and the best monocultivar that you're looking for in order to let this happen. And about the time when we were building Fairway, you know, in the mid-90s, I guess. And
were you there from the beginning with the, as it was starting to expand and all that?
No, everything we do totally accidental. We back into everything. We have no earthly idea what we're about. Everything that happens is serendipity, and just because we're paying attention, and everything bad, the same thing as we're not paying attention. We're not corporate planners. We're not businessmen. We're just counter people who now have 12 stores. Mm-hmm. That's all there is to that. But I realized in the mid-90s that every bottle of olive oil in town was not only stale, but it was a ripoff. Everything was imported by an importer distributor who really didn't have any passion for olive oil or vinegar or anything else for that matter. It just happened to be their business. And they would do business with whatever olive oil guy was offering them olive oil at whatever price. And then his business was to get a pretty label on it so that Mr. and Mrs. America would go, oh, that looks like it'd be really good by the design of the label and the shape of the bottle, which is preposterous. And as I'm a scold and a scourge, and I'm constantly heaping scorn on everything in my life because everything makes me angry. And it began to make me angry that here's all these fancy schmancy stores in New York City and funky old Fairway that purports to have the best ingredients of anything you could possibly look for anywhere in the world in order to provide the best dish you can, the best recipe execution you can. And I realized there was no decent olive oil here.
Which is at the foundation of all these dishes. So that's an important ingredient.
It's the most important ingredient in all of these dishes, as you say, Patrick. It's the foundation of them. And what I learned in April from the biggest olive oil competition the world has ever known that we New Yorkers threw down at the French Culinary Institute, which is now the International Culinary Center, but I got that venue for my friend Curtis Cord, who comes down here from Newport, and we used that beautiful venue. And we had the biggest competition the world has ever known.
Meaning what? How many olive oils?
We had 750-some entries. Wow. The Mario Salinas which is the most prestigious one that takes place in Rome or Milano, I can't remember. That's the most prestigious one. They have, you know, maybe half that many. Our judges were the most prestigious, accomplished, respected people in the olive oil industry in the world. That's a huge accomplishment right there. And we spent three solid days tasting all this. I wasn't a judge because I'm just aesthetic. I'm a rock and roller. These are chemists and microbiologists and people who are steeped in the chemistry of olive oil. They're qualified to do a competition like this. When you start putting in, you know, pretty boy aesthetics like me, it becomes a vanity contest, and I find that to be abhorrent. I think competitions, ooh, that guy's drinking a Bitburger. That's my brand.
Joe, get that Bitburger. Give it to Steve.
Joe, don't worry about it. Comparisons are odious. Uh-huh. To put all of those beautiful olive oils up against each other, or a whole bunch of cheeses, or a whole bunch of cattle, I find that to be odious because it's an insult.
What's the difference between number five and number four? Exactly. And one's huge company, one's a little guy.
Yeah. So I don't find competitions to
top
be
top 10 lists are usually lame.
But it's good for the industry. It's good for these folks because they learn something, all these people who are not in the olive oil business all that long. And it was amazing to me that more than half of the entries were fusty. They were rancid. They were oxidized olive oils from really sweet, well-meaning people who just didn't know how to mill their olives properly. On the other hand, we had almost half of those 750 people submit brilliant, brilliant olive oils. And what I learned over that three-day period, and I fashioned myself as knowing more about olive oil than anybody in the business, but what I learned over that 3 days trebled my experience in olive oil. I learned, and this is what your listeners tune in for, is what I'm about to tell you right now. You're not going to find a bottle of olive oil in a supermarket across this country that's worthy of you and worthy of your kitchen. So don't even think you're going to find a decent bottle of olive oil unless you're at a retailer who gets it. Now, lesson number two. When you're shopping for olive oil, you're only criterion has nothing to do with geography. Your criterion is that you must taste that oil, and it better be bitter, and it better be peppery, or don't buy it. Let me explain. When you're tasting olive oil, all these people that know me and that I respect and that have been coming along with me in this olive oil business, we taste olive oil and we start saying things like, oh, it's got some citrus, and oh, it's got a nice fragrance on the retronasal, and I get artichoke, and I get... That's all crap. Olive oil is not a food. It's not something that's supposed to taste good. It's,
right.
While I call it a ready-made sauce, which is what it is, on its own, it's going to be very pungent and bitter and hopefully peppery. But what that means, and this is a huge revelation, if your olive oil's bitter and peppery, that means it's an early harvest olive oil. And an early harvest olive oil has such vaulted levels of polyphenols, which are the free radicals, which are the substance that will make you live forever with no incidence of disease. Conversely, if it's a late harvest or mid-harvest olive oil, it's going to be what we call fruity, which sounds great. Yeah, everybody wants fruity olive oil. Newsflash. Fruity olive oil means that it's gone past the point where the polyphenol level drops like a rock. And the olive oil no longer contains the polyphenols because they have chemically changed and become oxidized. What does oxidized mean? Great word. People talk about organoleptics, and then they talk about oxidized, and everybody's eyes glaze over, but they think they know what they're talking about. When you hear oxidized polyphenols, you've got to understand that that means it's rancid. It's gone. It's approaching fusty. And before it gets to that stale flavor, you get fruitiness. Mm. So if fruitiness is what you're looking for, you're not only not doing yourself any good, you're harming yourself. Mm. Oxidized olive oil is not good for you. And the European community, who finally came across and said, you guys that are early harvest with high polyphenols, you can put that on the label. And Gino Cialetti, the head judge of the New York Olive Oil Competition, said, well, okay, if we can say that, then you've got to be
you got to let us also say, don't buy olive oil that's not early harvest. Mm-hmm. And the EC should say, take it off the shelves because it's hurting people. Now, that's a mouthful.
Well, that's a lot. But let me ask, do bottles that stay on the shelf for too long end up becoming late harvest oils on the shelf?
That's right. They get ruined by the time and the air that's in the bottle and the light that approaches it, even if it's a dark shaded or tin. Some light can get through a dark bottle, but not a tin. If the olive oil stays on the stand too long, it's stale and it's no longer good for you.
What's the right amount of time? I mean, 2 months, 3 months? Is there a date on olive oil bottles?
That's my whole thing about why I'm a better retailer than anybody else. I not only have 175 olive oils that I import.
175, that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. And I import two-thirds of them direct.
Yeah, under the Fairway brand.
Exactly. And then I hang all these informational posters that tell people the yeses and the noes about olive oil. You've got to be able to look at a bottle, and the label has got to do you the courtesy of telling you the sub-region of the region of the country that came in, because the country's not important, and almost the region isn't important. It's the sub-region that's important. That's criterion number one. Number two is, does it tell you when the olives were harvested? Because you do not buy an olive oil unless it's from the previous harvest. Mm-hmm. And all over town, in any fancy schmancy store in New York City, you're going to find shelf loads of olive oil today that were harvested and pressed in 2011. Mm. And that's unforgivable.
Too old.
That's unacceptable. Mm-hmm. Any fancy schmancy store that's selling high-end stuff should have the acumen to not have on their shelves olive oil that's from a prior harvest to 2012. And, of course, you know, if it's Peru or Chile or South Africa or Australia, you know, you want 2013 harvest olive oil today, mm-hmm. today. And I guarantee you, you're not going to find it unless you're at a Fairway. That's why I'm smug. That's why I know I'm better than anybody else.
That's
because
good.
I battle every January, February, and March to get rid of all those prior harvest oils. I got a lot of money wrapped up in olive oil. Mm-hmm. If I don't get rid of those, I'm sitting on oil that's stale. And
that
I ain't selling no stale oil. So I start marking the prices down.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two things that people, you know, about Fairway. One is the things that Steve creates are such high volume. So many people come that you have the luxury of high turnover.
Yeah, you know, but like, I'm not going to give all that away. We developed that high turnover because we're good retailers.
Yeah, but that's
a big part
of it. So
one depends on the other. You've got to be a good retailer to have that buying power.
And the other thing I love about Fairway is that people don't notice as much. It has the best, and Steve is behind these, the best, most witty and educational signage throughout the market. You can't go more than two steps without learning something and seeing something, and it's written with a sense of humor and an edge to it. It's really fun to shop there. You can't, going into Fairway, like, automatically teleports $20 out of your pocket. You cannot walk through there without buying something.
Yeah, my favorite part of Fairway is the olive oil section with the little pieces of bread. You can taste them and you can try them. If you can't find me in Fairway, you can usually find me by the olive oil.
But even a blockhead like me, I was going to taste all the wrong things until I learned these things at the New York Olive Oil Competition. Mm-hmm. I was looking for, you know,
bitter and peppery.
Herbiness. Oh, it's got a nice herbiness to it. That'd go good. You know, that's all total crap.
How do they taste olive oil? They just eat it every time?
Or same way you taste wine.
Same
you
wine.
Suck on it, your blood.
You breathe
through your nose for the retronasal, which is the most important. I want to talk to you a little bit about what we've learned about tasting as we get on, but I also wanted to give you the third criterion to buying olive oil.
Oh, yeah.
The label on the olive oil should tell you the variety of olive. But you're going to find all of these expensive olive oils all over town. They're $30, $35, $20, $25, a half liter, not even a liter. And you look at the label, and it won't even tell you what the region of the country is. It won't tell you when it was harvested, and it won't tell you what the variety of olive is. I find that reprehensible for any olive miller to be that vague about what he did and isn't proud enough about it to show you what it is. So I want our listeners to strive to buy olive oil that is early harvest, monocultivar, that means not a blend of two or three or four or five, six different olives, but is one olive, a Coratina, a Biancolila, a Frantoia. These are big, huge personality olives that need not be blended with anything else. Blending is how big olive oil companies make money. And it's a science and it's an art and it's a craft to blend olive oil. but it's not really worthy of you. We do that. These people do that to bring the price of the olive oil down so everything's not so expensive. Mm-hmm. But even the most expensive early harvest monocultivar extra virgin olive oil is a steal. It should cost three or four times that much. Thanks God there's Fairway Market where there's an importer and then there's a grove. There's nobody between me, your idiot savant importer, and the grove. There's no broker, there's no distributor, there's no importer. All of these people tack on money like crazy. The fancy label, the fancy bottle tacks on more money. Just like I did with cheese by buying it directly from the cheesemaker all these years. I buy all my olive oils directly from the miller, and I import them direct. Only people that are charging me anything is my customs broker and my freight forwarder. And that's purely and simply all there is to it. Remember this for me. Please remember this. Early harvest, monocultivar, meaning one variety of olive, extra virgin olive oil from this year's harvest, meaning 2012, if it's a Mediterranean basin olive oil.
Wow, very, very interesting. So, well, I mean, obviously all your knowledge and skills have been successful. I mean, it's the public that supports you because you've opened, you're just about to open your 13th store in Chelsea?
Yes, sir. At the end of June, we'll open a hybrid fairway, slightly smaller than the usual, at 25th Street and 6th Avenue in Chelsea.
Is that the last store since your Kips Bay store? Is it the most recent?
Yes.
Wow, the Kips Bay one is nice.
This guy's looking at his Bitburger like, hey, this is pretty good beer.
I think he's stressed that you're going to go and grab it from
him. We sell that in four packs, and I don't buy beer in bottles anymore. I buy beer only in those big cans. It's not a 12-ounce can. It's a half a liter can, a 17-ouncer, because they get so ice cold in the refrigerator, more so than any bottle of beer. And that Bitburger, ooh, man, is that,
by the way,
that's
Steve,
a Pilsner. That's a Pilsner beer from heaven.
Steve is looking out the window of our shipping container into Roberta's restaurant, so that's who he's referring to. We would never drink or do drugs on the air or anything like
take
that.
Our clothes
come on
off.
Now, please. Yeah, we're going to get naked.
I almost took my clothes off when you were talking about the cheese and terrace.
Oh, man. So it'd be raining all day, you know, and I'd stay up and smoke joint after cigarette after joint after cigarette, studying maps in my little garret room above the Rue de Seine till all hours of the night. And I would just not go to bed. And I would go down and I'd jump in my rental car and I'd drive out to the market south of town. This is the year after Léal was closed. Léal was the market in Paris that was right in the center of Paris where the Pompidou is now, where nothing ever goes on in the Pompidou. And there's this hideous mall that's just this huge 5-floor deep hole in the ground where they just ripped out Léal because it was too much of a mess. Too many trucks, too much diesel fumes, too many rats and all of that. And moved it out way south of Paris to a village called Rungis. And it became like the first corporate sector in the universe, you know, one of those horrible corporate areas. But it became the depot for everything edible and all the flowers that would come into Europe or from regional France, Spain, Italy, or wherever. Everything would come into Rungis and then go out to the rest of the world from Rungis. So that was the locus, focus, hocus pocus nexus of everything that I was into because it was where the cheese came and all the meat and all the poultry and all the flowers. They even had shops out there for all the hardware that any chef could want. They had bundles of that fabulous rye straw that for me was like big amplifiers were for me when I was a teenager. Well, I'd look at a big amplifiers and walls of speakers, and you know, I'd just get crazy. In these days, in my mid-20s, it was bundles of rye straw that were woven together so that you could put a cheese on it and it could breathe underneath it. That was something very foreign to New York, and I had to smuggle all that stuff in because, once again, the FDA wouldn't let that stuff in, even though it was immaculate. So I'd go out to Rungis before dawn at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it'd be cold, and I'd be let in because I had a card that one of my negociants gave me, and they wouldn't have even let me in. And I would just wander from big, huge Quonset hut to Quonset hut, each of which was dedicated to either cheeses or meats or flowers. And the first thing I saw, the first day I got out to Rungis in the cold, cold, black 4 o'clock morning, was a wooden pallet that had stacked up on it, fully 5-6 feet high, freshly shot wild boars from Savoie, from way up in the mountains in Savoie. And all of these black, fleeced boars lay there with little tags tied to their little feet, their little hooves. And they were blowing, fluttering in the wind, in the early morning wind, because it was raining, sleeting. And the stillness of those boars lying there, just inert, just totally, just freshly dead, not moving, but all the little tags on their little hooves were fluttering.
Did it look like that one? It's like that one. So these are all in the story, in the book Food Life, which everyone should read, because it's fun to read a bunch of essays rather than one 300-page book, you know, a bunch of individual thoughts. Recommend that to everyone. Real quick, I mean, I've got to ask this. So why the decision to go public? I mean, does that now put you guys on a plane to open more stores and
we opened,
change the food world for the better?
You know, it took us from 1972 to 1996 to get the second store opened.
Wow.
It's not like we're Whole Foods, a juggernaut or anything. We're just blockhead foodies who work a counter with an apron on. And so it took all that time to open store number two. That cost a lot of money. We opened a store out on Long Island in Plainview. That cost a lot of money, even though it was a turnkey operation from some other blockhead supermarket that went belly up. But we realized that the three guys that hired me, you know, they were getting about the age I am now. There's Marion Nessel. And there's Katie.
Oh, yeah, they must be doing their show together, Straight No Chaser. Or no, it's changed. What's the new name of her show, Joe?
It's called What Doesn't Kill You.
What Doesn't Kill You.
So you have to go to the bank to get more money. It's not like you got pocket money to open a store. Yeah. It's going to cost you $12 million. And if you keep doing that, you're so in hock to the bank, and suddenly you're my age and you're wanting to retire, but you owe so much money. Your business is fine, but you owe the bank so much money because you're opening new stores that you can't even retire. So what you have to do is use other people's money. And other people's money means you're going to pay a premium for it. So what we do is do an IPO and get a whole bunch of folks to invest. And so that's what we did. We raised about $180 million, and it was a huge success.
Good.
And the three original guys get bought out, and they're happy. And the equity, the white people that own us now, the equity group, are marvelous and let us do everything and don't mess with us. And
because it's a good thing. Were you, well, that's very interesting. I mean, congratulations. I mean,
thank
I
you.
Think that shows that you guys are doing it right. Were you very excited and moved by the way your Red Hook store was embraced after Hurricane Sandy?
I mean, the Red Hook thing beautiful. Is like one of the most emotional things I've ever had happen in my life. It is such a thing of maybe we're not screwed yet. Maybe there are some good people in the world, and maybe.
You were closed for months.
We don't have to be such cynics and so defeatist and have such scorn for so many other people, because everything that happened in Red Hook was brought out. That was brought out for me. We didn't let a single employee, and we're talking 400, 500 people, not one employee lost 1 hour of pay because of the storm, because we leased a bunch of buses and we bused them to our other stores and just fit them in and had an impact on the payrolls of my other stores so that we could accommodate all of the Red Hook people. And we're proud of that. We didn't tell anybody. People found out about it and they would ask us. And we said, yeah, that's the way we do things. That made me feel proud that we're the kind of people that would do a thing like that. Any other business would have just said, see ya, sorry about the storm. You know, if we ever get this back up, you know, come back and apply for a job and maybe we'll give you. That's not the way we operate. So we just very deliberately waited till the 5 feet of water subsided from the Red Hook store, which is right on the banks, you know. That's right where the ships would pull up and unload the blankets and the carbines and the cannonballs and all of the stuff that we fought the Civil War with. And that's where they unloaded it. And then, you know, it would be pulleyed up to one of those fabulous windows that are all over that building. And then it would be attached to a donkey. They would just walk the length of the building and pull all that heavy stuff up, and it would be stored there in our building. That's where the Fairway Red Hook is.
Five
feet of water, and it destroyed every bit of merchandise in there, destroyed every cash register, all of the refrigeration equipment. We threw away $2 million wholesale worth of food that the city made us throw away. We couldn't donate it to anybody because they, you know, it might be dirty or whatever. So it was a heartbreaker, absolute heartbreaker, because Red Hook is our heart and soul favorite store before the storm. It's just where
it's your second most money-making store, and you wouldn't really imagine that a place in the middle of the Red Hook would be
and
that.
And this Manhattan boy found himself out there four or five times a week just because I loved being in my Red Hook store. So that store was wiped off the face of the map, and we took X months from November, December, January, February, March, 5 months to rebuild that store brick by brick. Well, not bricks. The bricks were the only thing left. But the whole floor and all the ceilings and all the pipes and all the wires and all the refrigeration and all of those people and all of that merchandise, we put it back together. And by God, we had a grand opening that was the most joyous thing you ever saw. Kids were dancing and kids were playing instruments and people were during that period, we did everything we could for all the other shopkeepers in Red Hook to get them up and running too.
Because we
obviously had more of an infrastructure than any of them did. So we made friends. And a lot of those guys were people who went, we don't need Fairway in Red Hook. We've got this wonderful community all by ourselves. We don't need Fairway. And then they sort of changed their mind about Fairway. They realized that we're in it along with them.
They're
and we care
like
about
you,
them. And everybody pulled together, and the store's rocking and rolling. And for the last month, people hug each other in the aisles because they haven't seen each other in so long.
I will say that I had the fortunate experience of going to, I think it was like four fairways with Steve, and they were all in like weird places like Danbury and outside New York, and everybody, Steve cannot walk through his stores without people from behind the counters, hey Steve, hey, how's the old woman, hey, and
you're joking
with them. It's very, very warm. I hope you come back and tell us about your impending trip to Campania in Amsterdam. I'm sorry we didn't get to do it, but come back the second you're back. I want to thank Steve for being on, and I want to thank Bonnie and
Tanya
for being on. And thanks for listening, everyone. And stay tuned for, from what Steve tells me, Marion Nessel is about to be on Katie's show. We're engineered by Joe. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.